Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like, it's unbound, it's limitless, but we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves, and that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow, and this is the Goop Podcast, where we bring together visionaries, scientists, healers, artists, and seekers. I'm so grateful that I get to interview these extraordinary thought leaders and share their wisdom with you. And I love listening to the conversations that are led by my co-host and dear friend, Cleo Wade. Cleo is a beautiful poet and author. I deeply admire her and the way she keeps her heart open to the world. Together, we believe that engaging in open-minded, honest, and sometimes difficult conversations has the power to change our lives. All right, over to Cleo.
I'm excited to introduce today's guest, author and sociologist Corey Keyes. Corey's new book is called Languishing: How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. In it, he explores and gives language to that kind of feeling we've all had, the meh or blah feeling. Corey and I talk about the difference between languishing and flourishing, and the ways in which we can measure these states for ourselves. Corey says we live in a world that sees mental health as the absence of illness, but he explains how mental health should be thought of more as a constellation, not a singular solution. Where we focus on the presence of good things such as community and being of service to others in even the smallest ways, like showing up for a walk with a friend or being more intentional with your time. As you'll hear, Corey shares a bit about his own search for meaning and what sparked his research back in 2002. Corey describes feeling like a lost soul who is trying to find his way home, and that's where our conversation begins today. Let's get to my chat with Corey Keyes.
Hi, Corey. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. Thank you.
The cover of your book kind of made me giggle. Because you realize now I'm like, oh, that was the languishing emoji.
Yes. Well, I didn't realize that emoji is relatively new.
It is.
Yes. And when we came upon it, it really hadn't gained a sort of identity. And I think maybe.
I think you influenced it.
Well, we'll see.
I've so enjoyed going through your book and your work in general. So thank you for not only these contributions as someone who writes poetry for a living, the idea that we are naming these things we feel as a starting point to find some type of journey to heal or transform these things we feel has been truly so unbelievably valuable to me in my life. And so anyone who's creating language for our lives is really doing the Lord's work, in my opinion.
Well, thank you, because I take words and writing very serious. And there was a poem I came across shortly after I was no longer allowed to edit anything by a woman named Athy Thompson. I don't know if you've heard her, a British poet. And people have asked me sometimes, why did you write the book? And her poem nails it for me.
Do you have it on hand to read by chance?
I do. And I may actually tear up because it's really hits why my story is so intertwined with my search for flourishing. Sometimes people have wondered why I wrote the book, and there's a variety of reasons, but this poem captures it the most. And it's by Athey Thompson. It's taken from her book, A Little Book of Poetry. And here it is. I shall gather up all the lost souls that wander this earth, all the ones that are alone, all the ones that are broken, all the ones that never really fitted in. I shall gather them all up, and together we shall find our home.
That is so beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. And so by the time you went to publishing, it was a little too late to add that poem into the book.
Yes. And I do believe that in some respects, you could describe languishing, and I've felt it many times and throughout my life, and I still do. I do feel like a lost soul. Mm-hmm. I do resonate with that terminology, lost souls, trying to find our way in this place and trying to find a way to feel at home. Because the truth is, when I've discovered this way of looking at the world and studying it, flourishing really encapsulates when I'm feeling that, put it this way, I feel at home here.
Mm-hmm. Your book is called Languishing, and it's, you have created this definition of what this word means for us, and very importantly, gifted us kind of this new space to rest and have moments of contemplation in that is not called depression, which is what I found very helpful in reading your book, because as I went through it, I was like, yes, I know so many people in this who, you know, perhaps this would have been called depression or something else, but they don't feel that sense of helplessness and doom, but they do feel that stuckness. And so tell me about languishing versus flourishing.
Well, languishing has been described in some ways that I feel a little uncomfortable with, because it's a shorthand, but it doesn't do it justice. And some people describe it as being blah. Mm-hmm. And Adam Grant and others have used the descriptor meh. Mm-hmm. And while I understand where they were coming from, and it does convey a bit of it, I worry about that, because a lot of people feel blah because they go through 3 days of consecutive cloudy days and rain and cold. And, you know, that's not what I'm talking about. That's a mm-hmm. normal reaction. And by the way, even languishing can be a normal state of being. We'll get to that. But here's what it is. Now, in the book, I give you my 14 questions that I've used scientifically as a way to measure and diagnose the presence and absence of good mental health. Flourishing is the word I chose to be the stand-in for mental health, because when you use that word, mental health, without anything else, some people think you're talking about mental illness. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very clear when I talk about mental health, I'm talking about the presence of good things. And those 14 questions help me diagnose flourishing. And three of the questions refer to what I call emotional well-being. So I asked people in the past 2 weeks or past month, how often did you feel either happy, satisfied, or interested in life? Pretty straightforward questions. And we talk a lot about happiness in this country and the world. When we talk about well-being, that's what people usually think about. But the remaining questions have to do with what I call functioning well. And there's two groups, one psychological well-being and the other social well-being. And the difference between the two reflects the very nature of being human. Psychological well-being privileges the pronouns I and me. And social well-being privileges the pronouns we and us. And human beings just shift fluidly, unconsciously between the two every day. And so here are some of the things I measure with psychological well-being. Does your life have meaning and direction? That's called purpose in life. Mm-hmm. Are you having experiences that are challenging you to grow and become a better person? That's called personal growth. Do you feel confident to think and express your own ideas and opinions? That's called autonomy. Are you able to manage your life? We call that mastery, a very basic notion of mastery. Do you like most parts of your personality? That's called self-acceptance. Do you have warm, trusting relationships? That's called positive relations. So it's that sort of thing that measures psychological well-being. Social well-being is, in the past, how often did you feel that you belonged somewhere to a community? You know, a lot of us would say we're part of something, but we don't necessarily feel we belong just because we are part of something. That's called integration. Another question I ask in social well-being, do the things that you do on a daily basis matter to the world around you or people or your community? Are you contributing anything? Are you able to make sense of what's going on in the world? That's called coherence. Do you believe you're part of a society where it's becoming better or it's a good place for most people? That's called social growth. And so those are the kinds of questions when it comes to functioning well as a human being. And to flourish is to feel at least 6 out of the 11 signs of functioning well every day or almost every day, and at least one of the feeling good every day or almost every day. And languishing is just the opposite. You rarely, if ever, feel at least 6 or more of those 11 questions that represent social or psychological well-being. So you don't have a lot of good things going on in your life, and you don't feel rarely, if ever, happy, satisfied, or interested in life. So languishing is the absence of feeling good about a life that matters or has meaning or is worth living. Mm. It's the absence of good things.
What I find is so interesting and cool and also feels intuitive is the ways in which all of the kind of me stuff is intertwined with the we stuff. Because I do think in a lot of the ways that helping oneself, or what we would call the self-help world, has really centered it on we've almost taken that kind of American dream template, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentally and go it alone. And then when you get to this destination, then you arrive and all of these things will arrive with you. You know, I say this all the time when someone says, I'm not doing this, this, and this because I'm focusing on myself right now. And I always feel that it's so important to toggle between the focus on oneself, because the world doesn't take a break from you. And this re-entering and exiting is actually, to me, difficult. So there's this idea where there's this micro way to kind of have those moments to focus on oneself, to, you know, restore, relax, reflect, but to completely remove yourself from the experience of us in being in beloved community, actively wanting to build beloved community. I imagine that leaving that practice makes it harder to value it, which makes you more estranged from it, and then much harder to re-enter it, which ends up being a critical link.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in addition to sort of like pull yourself up, I think people, at least in our society, feel that they don't deserve to feel many of the things that go into flourishing until they've earned it. So you have to work hard and you have to be hard on yourself. And I had a version of that. Trust me, I've been there, done that, and realized just because you're doing the hard work of personal growth doesn't mean you have to be hard on yourself. Yeah. It's just the opposite.
Yeah.
Passion and self-compassion is the ingredient. And I write about that. But in addition to that is this notion that somehow we can gain our well-being if I do something good for me, do something nice for me, treat myself.
Right.
And I get that and I understand that it has its place. But when we get to talking about what I call the 5 vitamins, what you've done is set them up beautifully, because when you're doing any one of those things, you're not only doing something good for yourself, generally speaking, you're also doing something good with or for other people. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. I don't think we realize how much when the things that we want to belong and to contribute and to accept ourselves comes when we do the same thing for others. I love this notion that we get by giving, and that's the nature of flourishing. If we want warm, trusting relationships, be that for other people, and surprise, surprise, you will get those things.
Well, and wouldn't you say that service and a connection to being of service to others is a huge part of having any relationship? Because I think a lot of the times when we think about, especially if someone's feeling stuck, it's kind of hard to ask them to do for others.
I
would imagine we need these momentum builders, and getting into community and starting to do for others and decentering the self so that you can find flow perhaps in someone else's experience, I think is still an energy that probably I know for myself has helped me find flow if I was feeling that kind of stuckness in my own stuff. But I do think that sometimes people think, okay, well, what's the big organizing thing I have to do to be of service? When really calling the one family member who perhaps doesn't have a lot of listeners in their lives to just say, how are you? And allowing them to monologue on in their kind of fashion that they do, or knowing that if your friend is going through a hard time and, you know, you're going to have a kind of unidirectional conversation, looking at a service to say, yeah, some days you have this really great bi-directional flow with how you're in conversation and it's really collaborative and it's really even. And some days your friend is in need and they really need a listener. And that's truly all they need. And perhaps if they request counsel at the end, you could give some, but mostly that service will also create some type of way in which you're kind of channeling another human experience, and that giving ends up being a greater energetic receiving.
You're right. When people feel stagnant or stuck, it's hard to sort of think, well, if I get out of myself, get outside of myself, I will suddenly start to feel something that's alive. I will start to be alive. And what's remarkable about helping, and that's one of the five vitamins I recommend, is that you can do it really small, but you have to really have hope. Remember the intention. I talk about the intention. Always check your intention. So go out there and help and keep it small. And one of the most amazing things you can do to help somebody is to really be interested in them and what's going on in them or with them. And I've heard recently people talking about learning to listen in the corporate world, and they train people to listen, to listen well. We don't listen as much, and we're not as interested in as each other. And I think it would go a long way to connecting meaningfully, warmly, and building trust, which is for a moment, just be really interested in that family member or that friend or that colleague and ask them some questions and do it out of kindness and trying to help.
Yeah.
And that you're socializing, connecting at the same time you're helping. That's two of the five vitamins right there. And it's a wonderful way in which they always seem to bleed into each other.
Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
Something I've thought a lot about when it comes to listening lately is it being a practice similar to meditation, in that in awareness, there's, and when you're trying to create a period of 15 minutes or 20 minutes of awareness in meditation, there's the drifting off and the consistent, you know, homecomings that you have to ask of yourself. And I think that in a world, or, and I wonder what you would say about that, we bring very little awareness to most activities now. So it's, you know, even if you're watching a movie at home, you might be on your computer and on your phone at the same time, or we have, you know, one of my kind of rules for my life is that I don't think multitasking is possible and I don't try to do it. I really do feel that I can only do one thing at a time well, or with awareness and intention. I have two small children, and that's how I'm able to intentionalize my time with them. So if I know I'm going to sit in the car with them and maybe be in the back seat with them, you know, I won't bring my phone into the car because I don't feel that I can bring awareness to our connection and also be able to order paper towels on Amazon at the same time. My partner and I go on a walk every day together pretty much. And when we do, I ask that we don't bring phones, because I don't think that with this, our ability to multitask, that we can have meaningful connection. And, you know, those meaningful connective moments, even if they're just for 20 minutes or a 7-minute car ride to school, are, I think, hugely beneficial to our relationships. And this idea that we're trying to optimize every minute too, I'm sure contributes to our languishing, our burnout.
Yeah. Well, there's this study I talk about when it came to the vitamin of play and leisure, that some people have the mindset that it's not a good use of their time. And some even go to the extreme and say it's a waste of time. And others, in part because we've commodified time, it's sort of like time is money. And and when you do that, when you're engaging in leisure, especially the good stuff, the active stuff, right? Remember that the passive stuff, which we're doing a lot more today, the passive kind of play and leisure is really not beneficial to flourishing. But the active stuff, if the mindset is that that's not a good use of your time, right? You're probably multitasking,
well,
and you're not present. And
yeah,
you're
we're also a culture of no hobbies anymore. There's this disappearance of hobbies. I've been talking about this with a lot of friends lately, partially because I have one friend who, as she transitioned out of her marriage, I saw her picking up these hobbies all of a sudden. And I remember thinking, wow, this is so novel, because I haven't seen someone just be doing paint by numbers all the time or learning to cook a perfect steak at a cooking thing. You know, we're like, even if we learn to knit, we think we should have a hat stand somewhere nearby, or set up a shop online. And this idea that, you know, hobbies are ways that we organize space for play and awareness to, you know, mental, spiritual, physical connection into art or something of interest to us, which has got to be pretty medicinal, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of all the five vitamins, where when you're doing them with the intention, which is to become a better person for others, rather than the intention, which is the external path, which is to become better than others at what you're doing, you're stepping out of time and into the experience itself. There's nothing more beneficial. You use the word flow, but I would thought we don't even have to talk about flow. When you're really engaged in play, are you really connecting with somebody? If you're really helping somebody, if you're really engaging in the spiritual vitamin or the religious one, right? Or, and so forth, with the intention to become a better person, you're stepping out of the commodification of time for a moment to do something that has no other use in the marketplace. It may benefit, but the real benefit is that you become a better person for others. The wonderful benefit of focusing on that, I call it the internal path, is that suddenly the things that go into functioning well and flourishing, like purpose, belonging, contribution, acceptance, they come to you, they emerge, they begin to be present in your life, because we need to step out of this notion of time, that time has got to be all useful and productive. And if we do anything, we have to make money off of it and show it to others. If the external path is the only way we pursue flourishing, and I'm not saying you can't get some of the things in flourishing if you're sort of flexing the muscle of competition. That's right. That's the external, right? I don't think that kind of flourishing is a sustainable one.
Well, I was wondering when you were talking earlier about words like blah or meh, or like, you know, needing days of, you know, not necessarily, you didn't say needing days of blah, but a blah could come from just a 3-day stretch of bad weather.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also, when you were saying that, I was wondering, because we are in this culture of overdrive that we truly call hustle and grind culture, this idea that we hustle, constant movement, ground ourselves into pieces or into dust, you know, do we also mistake blah for like a relaxing afternoon because we have associated, you know, guilt, or as you were saying, most people think that play or time for restoration is, or a lot of people call that a waste of time, if not, don't value it at all. Because something I thought was also really interesting you talk about in the book is finding this kind of movement in your feelings rather than going from uncomfortable feeling to comfortable feeling, this idea that we have movement in our feelings and that they happen and we can kind of move with them in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so don't you think that maybe the law could be mistaken for the someone who is uncomfortable relaxing?
A lot of people describe languishing itself as an uncomfortable place to be,
right?
In part because you were talking about moving with your feelings. Languishing is feeling very little good or very little bad. It's the absence of either set of feelings. And some people describe it as feeling like you're dead or dying inside, and some people describe it as numb. And a lot of people talk about it as emptiness.
Mm.
And that blah, I suspect people would be able to distinguish that blah, which is in that emptiness, and that from serenity and contentment, or right. I think, or even there are moments in my afternoon, and I do this a lot more in the afternoon. I don't know why. I kind of daydream. I'll disappear for a moment where it's like, and then when I come back, it's kind of like, that was kind of a nice disengagement.
Mm-hmm.
But that feels really good. And languishing is a normal reaction. But if you stay there too long, just like sadness and fear, both, you know, sadness, if it's too long and too strong, becomes depression. Fear, if it it persists too long and is too strong, it becomes anxiety. Languishing, if it persists, it becomes a very detrimental thing. And I described that early on in the book, all of the things I've charted. Even if you've not been mentally ill, if you stay too long in languishing, one of the reasons I'm convinced that more and more people are ending up mentally ill is they spend too much time in languishing. And I'm not saying it's a conscious thing. They stay there, but I think they get stuck. At most, 10% of the world has a common mental illness in any typical year. As much as 40 to 50% of people are languishing, depending on what subgroup or country you're measuring. It's an enormous, unrecognized, invisible problem that I want to be careful about saying, well, it's comfortable there. I think people will distinguish between a place where, like, I went to daydream a bit and that felt good, or I feel just calm and I want to do nothing today because I'm serene and I'm content. I'm content.
Right.
Yeah.
How much do you think our phones are contributing to languishing?
I think to the extent that we use that as a surrogate for the things I recommend in the second half book of the book, where you're not really helping somebody, you're not really connecting warmly, where you're not engaging anything spiritual or religious, where you're not playing, where you're not learning something new and growing personally. I think to that extent, media and the phone can really get in your way I want to reserve a little space for the fact that some people will use it as a portal in which to learn and grow and to connect with others in a community. And it depends, right? I mean, I've seen the social media iPhone research, and it really depends on your intention and the reason you're going there.
Yeah, because I've definitely watched fandom bring people together. I mean, we look at Taylor Swift fans, or I've seen two people be fans of the same major pop artist and then meet and get married, and all their friends are all in that same group of fans. And perhaps without the internet, none of them would have been able to meet if they couldn't have tweeted at each other. Yeah. And I think that that's really cool and fascinating. And then I also see how, you know, men who I know that struggle to make friends, they really find a lot of warmth, connection, growth by these kind of talky podcasts around sports or whatever it is. And that's very connective. But then there's the scroll, which to me, I feel like even when I'm reading about languishing is the kind of deeper, grander thing. But I think my symptom of, if I feel that I can even have micro moments of languish, it's in the scroll, where it's like there's no a commitment to nothing. There's this kind of glazed over movement where you intentionalize no way in which you're here, and there's no presence.
No,
but somehow your brain is involved.
It is in tracking, and that's about it. It's like I like to say, we human beings are like anything else that's been planted on this earth. We were planted here to grow, literally and figuratively. And those things that I describe in the second half book are ways in which we are doing the equivalent of what plants do to photosynthesize and really flourish. That's our version of feeling alive. And I don't think scrolling, it doesn't feel alive, if it's not giving you this sense that you're growing and going somewhere as a person. Yeah. But you brought up men, and I thought this was an interesting example, another where two of the vitamins would be very important. I remember what men, where they're engaging in some form of hobby or leisure, have an interest in common with other men. That's how they also connect meaningfully.
Yep.
Right? That's where two vitamins, again, come together. The connecting meaningfully around a version of leisure is a particularly, not exclusively, but a particularly conducive way for connecting men with each other.
My girlfriends and I talk about this all the time because I am obsessed with friendship. And I was saying that, you know, ways in which I observe men struggling in friendship is actually because they happen to bond over hobbies and not kind of emotional states. So when you bond over emotional states, you have a new emotional state all the time. So you're calling your friend being like, and then I felt this today. And then this made me feel this and da 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 da. And all of these things are kind of an emotional bond. And men say they have a surgery and stop being able to play basketball with the guys that they played pickup basketball with once a week, then all of the relationships fall by the wayside. Or if you're, you know, I live in Los Angeles, and it's a very much an industry town of Hollywood, and you'll see people be on set and, you know, all the men are best friends while they're all working on the same movie. And then you wonder, okay, because to me, I mean, I'm still best friends with my best girlfriend from Little League and my best friends from seventh grade homeroom. I was at her baby shower yesterday. So to me, that's a very purposeful part of a lot of my relationships are a lot of how I find and feel purpose in life. And so but with men, I especially found that this book it's crazy because when I read your book, there was more I highlighted for my partner than I did even for myself, because I felt that this would be so helpful and practical for men specifically, especially as we see more and more articles about this friendship recession that face men in particular.
Yeah. in the section where I talk a little bit, I don't do a lot, but a little bit about the gender differences by race. And if you were to look on the side of mental illness, what we call a sort of internalizing disorders, the disturbances of mood or affect, white women have higher rates of things like depression and anxiety than white men. When you look at the mental health side that I measure, the presence, absence, flourishing and languishing, white women are doing better in terms of flourishing than white men. Mm. But you would have thought white men are doing better because they have lower rates of internalizing disorders, but they're not. They're more likely to be languishing than their female counterparts. And I think there is, but this isn't true in every racial ethnic group. And my point in bringing it up, I think generally not just in white men, but I think I remember coming across this particular study of how to talk to a young boy when you have to talk about something serious or quasi-confrontational. Or even if you really want to talk about something serious, you don't sit, pull them in close and look them face to face. Like my coach used to do this to me in football. And it was the I hated it and I wanted to back away. And I was the quarterback. He would pull me in by the face mask and look me right in the face. And I was like, all of a sudden I shut down. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear a damn thing he said. But if you put your arm around him or you say, walk with me.
Yeah.
And you're side by side and you're talking. It's like, oh, I hear you. And it suddenly is so much less confrontational and stressful. Yeah. And you're not on guard. And you can connect even around difficult things. And I think we don't understand this. I think with men, you sit them down and you want to have a serious talk. Oh my God, do I not feel comfortable. First of all, I need to move. And I want you to walk with me. Yeah. Just walk with me. I feel better. And I already feel connected to you. So I can talk about tough things now.
Yeah.
I don't know why we don't realize that. I'm not saying that's not a good way to approach women as well, but I think women are far less wired and socialized to see this kind of real face-to-face stuff as immediately like you need to be on guard.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Why is this person looking at me that closely?
Mm-hmm. But I mean, you notice it even with small children. If I try to say to my 4-year-old, okay, look at me, she can for a second, but she doesn't even, you know, and even if it's not about, you know, it's not even in the midst of conflict, but say I'm trying to like get her to hear me because she is like, you know, looking at 20 things in the room and I'm like, Memphis, like, please take your plate from me. Do you know? I'm like, look at mom, look at me. And she'll look at me for a second. But I think we come from, there's that kind of old school culture of like, look at me when I'm talking to you kind of thing, which I think is in a moment of stress, vulnerability. For me, I have a 2 and a 4-year-old, so meltdown. It's actually not helpful. It's like, it's the hug. It's the, do you want to hold my hand? It's the come outside with me. You know, kind of starting to move.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting? I remember coming across the research and reading about play. And that one of the most important precursors in early infancy is the ability for the infant and the mother or father, when they're being held, to engage in that gaze, to look each other in the eye. It's at that point, it's right. There's a way of connecting with the infant that extremely comforting. Yeah. They have a name for it, and I'm blanking on it right now, but that gaze is so important when the infant is so dependent. I do wonder, and I'm wondering aloud, and I admit this, that when they start to get a little older and a little more mobile, and they're like in a little, just a tiny bit less dependent, that gaze and that ability to look at you, the adult, in the eye depends on, you know, the tone of voice. And do I see a little smile in her face or is this getting serious?
Yeah.
And I want to look away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's amazing to me that a lot of connection requires us to be so finely tuned to each other and to see the effect I'm having on you and to being able to modulate that in real time to maintain a really constructive, beneficial, warm, trusting relationship and contact. Right? It's real time. And I think we all know that, but sometimes we want to get things done. And it's like,
we are certainly a culture of efficiency.
Yeah. I want to get something done. I want you to take that plate and get to work. And there's a place for that. It's like, that's not a place necessarily. I'm just going to, okay, I don't need to all the accoutrements of warm, trusting, all this. We just need to, we need things to get done so that we can get on with doing other things.
Yeah. And then what, you know, it's very much this kind of, this value in where you go rather than how you get there. But most of life is getting there. And oftentimes there is no there. And so that's the other kind of hard part in that.
No, and that's the thing about, you reminded me of a very important point, that even when you're mentally healthy, flourishing, you know, it just because you've arrived, so to speak, doesn't mean that's where you stay. And in the study that sets up the second half of the book, I found it quite remarkable. People who are flourishing did more of those five activities that I write about. But if they stopped doing them, they started moving very quick. Sure, it didn't take a long time after just stopping to doing any one of those five things. They started drifting towards languishing. And if they had a day where they didn't do any of those five things, their day was just as bad as someone who was depressed or languishing who did nothing. But the good news is, if you do one of those five things, even if you're depressed or languishing, you have a much better day than anyone else who did nothing. And if you continue to do those things, it doesn't take long. And you're starting to move out of languishing, out of depression, slowly. You don't go from 1 to 10 just in a week or a month, but you start moving towards flourishing. But here's the thing, even people who are mentally healthy, if they do nothing, they have this same bad day as those who are depressed, who are languishing, who do nothing. And so it is important somehow that we sort of prioritize the process and how important those things are to staying there, that is getting and staying mentally healthy, and also to the journey, and that it's not a one and done thing.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing thing, and you will move in and out of flourishing. You will move. Yes, you can move out of languishing.
Something I was so struck by is just how long you've been studying this, and so many people heard of your work through the New York Times article by Adam Grant that went viral, but you've been doing this since 2002, really focusing on this languishing versus flourishing and this term languishing specifically. But what kind of brought you into it? You know, we have all of these spaces dedicated towards these wider ways that we approach mental health and mental wellness. And surely we weren't using the words mental health the way that we do now. And wellness was, you know, perhaps yoga, but you thought of as more of a body thing. So this idea that we have a mental wellness approach either, or that it's a mind-body connective thing, is something that has really, I think, gotten much, is a much bigger community with a lot more thought, resources. Now, what was it like for you in 2002, kind of coming into the space with this new word, idea, movement in a way?
I was told, Cleo, what serious scholars study is mental illness. And moving into this space, you had to believe strongly in its importance, because I've written about this, and one of the first challenges I faced in this space was that you're born into a world where people, before you have defined for you what's important, what gets our attention, and by the same token, what's unimportant to them and what remains invisible. And what I began to study was considered unimportant in the scholarly world, and in the medical healthcare world as well. And it remained invisible. So when I started bringing this out of invisibility, people started pushing back. And they said it was useless, worthless. Why are you wasting your time? Kind of a response. And I'm like, why isn't this an interesting world? As soon as you take what they consider unimportant and start making it invisible, they start thinking your attitude is you're telling them what they think is important, isn't it? That was never my message. I know mental illness personally. I know it's serious. And I'm here to tell you it keeps getting worse. And we're not changing the way we're approaching it. We keep doing more of this. And we keep saying there's not enough services for people. And that's true. And then we think we made progress by trying to train more people to treat more mentally ill people. And you will not treat your way out of a public health problem this big. And so I was convinced, and I had to be convinced, because I knew personally, when I was adopted, suddenly I was taken out of a horrifying, abusive situation. So suddenly there was the absence of all the negative, but it didn't mean automatically that there was the presence of all this good stuff that I felt. Yes, my grandparents gave me a wonderful, loving, safe home. And I went from being in detention in horrible grades before the adoption and with the abuse to suddenly in my grandparents' place, I was on the honor roll. I became involved in choir. I was the quarterback. I was playing basketball. I had friends. I was engaged. But as soon as I stopped doing those things, that emptiness inside emerged and languishing. Suddenly I was free of all that bad stuff. But just because I was in a good situation didn't mean suddenly I was flourishing. I felt emptiness and languishing. It takes a long time to find that flourishing after the start I had. And so I was what the Buddhists call a hungry ghost. And I had a big belly that was empty, because that's what trauma does to you. It takes away what you could have and what you think you were, the person you were going to be. That person's gone. And then you have to reconstruct a person and a life. And that's what I did. And my grandparents gave me a taste of what it is to flourish. I knew that it takes a lot more than the absence of the negative. In my life, I needed the presence of what they gave me and years of it to suddenly flourish. And I knew from there on, because I get the dedication of the book is to my Nana and my Papa, where the seed, they gave me a home where the seeds of flourishing were sown. I knew. And so my career was devoted to studying this and making the case. And yes, there's a lot of science that if you're flourishing, all kinds of good things come. You're protected and buffered and resilient from a lot of things that I talk about. And if you languish, you will end up, if you stay there too long, it is the gateway for a lot of serious problems like depression. You become, right? And so my argument is we need to complement and change the way we're approaching the mental health problems in our world by dealing with languishing and promoting mental health. Because when we promote what we say we want, we can prevent a lot of the things we cannot treat our way out of. That's the argument. We do not have to continue to do the same old thing, which is thinking we can treat our way out and wait for people to break down and become mentally ill. We can deal with languishing before it becomes an even worse problem. Because here's the thing, Cleo, people can have depression and be languishing, and their level of well-being measured using my measure with that mental illness. So their level of well-being will determine how well they function with that mental illness.
Right?
So it's not like, just because you're mentally ill, you suddenly no longer languish. You leave it behind. You leave it at home. No, it comes with you. And so severe languishing on top of depression is way worse than moderate languishing on top of depression. the problem with our country is we get obsessed with one thing at a time, and we try to deal with things piecemeal. So what that the Surgeon General cares about loneliness? Yes, it's a problem, but as I said in the book, you know, loneliness rarely happens on its own or alone. It comes with a loss of purpose, a loss of growth, a loss of contribution, and a bunch of other things. And yet here we want to deal with it piecemeal. I'm tired of that approach. We need to focus on something like mental health that's not just one question. It's a constellation. And I measure flourishing, as I said, there's 14 questions. But you need to have 7 out of the 14 as a minimum, every day or almost every day, with 1 from the feeling good and 6 or more from the functioning well. Right? To be whole is to have your combination, whatever combination you want to put together, right? We don't all flourish in the same way, mm-hmm. but we all have to flourish at meet some level of criteria, at least 6 or more out of the functioning well, combined with 1 of the 3 feeling good. And you don't have to be Superman or Superwoman. You don't need them all. You just need half of them.
Yeah.
And when you cross over that threshold, there's something, I'll call it magical. Even as a scientist, I don't know what it is, but when you cross over that threshold, when you have at least 7 or more with that combination, something magical happens and you are doing well in life.
Mm.
You are flourishing. I can't think of a better word. That word still kept. You are growing, you are giving, you are carrying on the chain of life. You're giving, you're getting, you're growing, you're learning.
Well, Corey, I want to thank you so much. That's such a beautiful encouragement for us, because, you know, in a world where we keep saying the one solution for this, the one thing to do this, someone who has been doing this work as long as you have, really encouraging us to be and do for ourselves this and kind of create our own constellation of warmth and loving gestures and acts of service towards ourselves and others is so important. And I truly resonated with so much of your research, and I'm so excited to know your work more and more and to know you. And I'm really grateful for this time. I'm just going to say this one last thing, because when I was reading your book, what I loved about you asking when someone took, you put your kind of survey or checklist around languishing in the beginning of the book. But before you do, you have a little note that says, and feel free to look to fill this out after you've read the book. And I love that you kind of created this way for different personality types to engage with that, because I thought that was so valuable. And I didn't know what to expect going into this conversation together. And I had this, when I read your book, I had a group of friends who I wanted to send the book to, including my partner. And then post this conversation, I have a whole other set of friends that I now want to send your book to, because it's such important work. And I do hope that we have a world that wants to change and grow as we are naturally meant to be. And I know that your work will help us do that so much if we can get our shit together.
Well, but on that note, you know, it's not an accident that, you know, the way I measured the presence of mental health, calling it a constellation, a combination of things, that I've always viewed flourishing as my North Star. I write about that. It is always something I remember when I'm starting to feel lost and empty. I know I need to look in the sky, so to speak, and literally, where is my North Star? Well, I am missing purpose. I'm missing belonging. I'm missing a sense of autonomy, mastery, growth, and acceptance. Those are the things that always guide me home. We need a North Star in our lives. And I think our public health and medical system needs to catch up with us. That's what we're about.
Yeah.
We're more complicated than just reducing it down to loneliness or whatnot. We're a lot more than that. Yes, we need warm, trusting relationships, but on top of that, we need the other things that go into flourishing. So remember, your constellation of flourishing is your North Star too.
Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode with Corey Keyes. His book, Languishing, is out now. Thanks for tuning in. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening to the Goop Podcast.